You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina, and globally at WPVMFM.org.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Cloudy skies early today with a chance of showers. Gradual clearing with a high in the upper 60s to near 70. Wind gust around 30 miles per hour. Tonight, a chance of showers after midnight with mostly cloudy skies overhead. The low falling to around 44. A chance of showers and rain on Saturday. Partly sunny by the afternoon with a high reaching 61. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today I'm going solo. My subject is unlabeling. Recently, a friend of mine, Aditi Sete, reached out and asked me to consider the possibility of doing a 5-minute talk around the idea of unlabeling death, which is to say, we have strong labels on death, how we see it, how we interact with it, how we experience it in others, how we anticipate the experience in ourselves. She was saying the labels we have can be very rigid. Her idea, she proposed to me, how do you change the way you unlabel your sensibilities around death? And how do you create different kinds of meaning around death, which is something that we are all approaching? It may be the only certain thing in our life, death. We know it's going to happen. We've seen it happen. And we sense it all the time, even if we don't talk about it all the time. It's a primary character in our lives. Even though it has weight and it's heavy and we approach it with a bit of trepidation, we also use it in our daily conversations very casually. Like, you're killing it, which means you're doing really, really well, even though to kill something means it dies after you kill it. Or you're out on a long walk around Beaver Lake with someone who walks fast, you might say, he really almost walked me to death. When your subtext is, I was really pleased to be walking fast with my friend. I didn't expect to. I'm getting healthier and healthier. No death in the picture at all. It's actually moving in the direction of more longevity in your life. So this isn't to make light of the big D death. Aditi is quite right about relabeling it. We have a narrow view of it. You may be afraid of death. You may not think about death. You may find yourself laughing about it when someone you know dies. You might find yourself noticing it but casually ignoring it. You might be thinking, I wonder what it will be like when I die. Will it be the most pleasant experience I've ever had? Considering that building up to it might not be so pleasant, but the moment of death could be very pleasant. Many people will tell you they've died or seemingly died, gone away, came back again. The near-death experience, they call it. So in English, we call it death. Every language, no matter how obscure or prominent, has one word or more than one word to describe this experience we've named death. By saying we've named it death also implies it's a main character in our lives. We each have a death playing its role in our lives. Your death will be different than my death, and yet it's there, almost as if it's the primary spirit speaking to us. May not be true with you, but I get the sense that it is true with a lot of people, certainly true with me, and it appears as a character in a lot of poetry. E.E. Cummings, for example, in his poem titled Buffalo Bills. Buffalo Bills, defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? E.E. Cummings relabels Death, turns it into a character, Mr. Death, and he's speaking to Mr. Death, wondering if Mr. Death can give him some wisdom, some insight into a long-ago historical character who lived and was very famous. Now, so remote in history, living somewhere in the historical mist, in books, in stories, in poems like the one E.E. Cummings wrote. I do like the idea of relabeling things, and yet I wonder if we can relabel relabeling. And what I mean by that is, instead of eliminating one definition and putting another, really relabeling is expanding, giving the label that we have much more dynamic possibilities to work with rather than keeping it narrow. We could say we're going to broaden it or unnarrow it. Is unnarrow a word? I don't know. But if you have something that's very narrow and you want it to be more expansive, you do broaden it. I do like the idea of unnarrowing, like unlabeling. And what I like about the idea of unlabeling, broadening, rewidening, making a broader perspective, is this can apply to every word we know and all the new words that we will come to understand and come to know. Our vocabularies are always changing. Our vocabularies are always growing, shrinking, doing all kinds of new things. Words get shifted around all the time. Usage changes all the time. A good example of one of the most useful, flexible words that we have in English is the F word. Can't say it on the radio, but you know which word I'm talking about. How many meanings does that word have? The D word, the death word, that's also another word that can have multiple meanings. There are a few heavyweights like that in our language, but mostly the words aren't the heavy lifting words that we have all kinds of responses to. Most of the time, the everyday words we use are simple and easy to understand. Take, for example, the word dog. Does the word dog need unlabeling? Does the word dog need expansion? Do we all understand exactly what we mean when we say dog? And then when you put dog and death together, what happens? So here's a story about how the word dog became a lot more than just the word dog, how it got unlabeled and then relabeled again, unlabeled and relabeled again. This story is about some students in a small classroom, about a teacher named Tom Tracy, and an experience I had with all of those teachers during a lightweight writing session, which I facilitated for Tom's middle school students, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. It was a small school, and the children were bunched together. If you live in the Asheville area, you may have seen Tom perform on the stage with Alan Wolfe and Alex Alford in a group they've had for many years called the Dead Poets. Here we are back to death again. The Dead Poets repurpose old poems written by masters, put music around them, and sing them as songs. Tom has a terrific singing voice, and he can play a guitar like crazy. So he was really able to join in with the Dead Poets and make these poems that you've heard read aloud come alive with music. Tom also produced for years a spectacle using children on stage musicals, children who were the very young kindergarten students all the way up to seniors in high school. Massive spectacles, sold out 4 or 5 to 10 shows every year. The last show I attended was in Owen High School auditorium. So Tom had a knack and still does have a knack for putting these kinds of great things together. He was also a very good teacher, sensitive to the needs of the students. So when Tom asked me to come in and teach these students a little bit about writing, I knew right away I can't really teach writing. I can set a tone. I can create an atmosphere, an environment that feels safe enough, open enough, full of permission, so people can play around with their imaginative work and generate something on the page. So the students in Tom's class, and this is understandable because I had experienced it in many other classes as well, they were just not sure. What do you expect? 6th, 7th, and 8th graders? Just getting their feet wet, just learning how they can express themselves, just allowing their voices to find them. For them to find their voices. It's a mutual finding. We're all born with the voice. We don't really need to look very far for it. It's not lost. It's right there. It's just waiting to be acknowledged, recognized, brought forth. So I figured, why make this all that complicated? I said to these students, okay, let's take a look at one word. How about dog? How many of you know what a dog looks like? Well, as you can imagine, the students all raised their hands. Sure, I know what a dog looks like. Yeah, I know what a dog is. I can define the word dog. So I said, what does the word dog mean? So one student said, well, it's an animal that barks. Another one said, oh, it wags its tail. Another one said, it has fur. So they're working around a bit in defining the animal. They didn't define it scientifically, but they were experiencing the dogs they had encountered and expressing what they had experienced around the dogs they had encountered. So as they described the dogs they had encountered, they generally got a pretty good definition. So we all finally concluded that a dog was an animal that had four legs. It had a tail that usually wags. It had ears. It has a muzzle, teeth, a nose, eyes, and it barked. So everybody could agree with that. So then I said, well, how many of you have had experiences with dogs? And everybody, of course, has. Most people have had an experience with a dog. Everybody knows what a dog looks like. And then I shifted it a bit. This is where I unlabel the dog and put a new label on it. I said, so, interesting. A dog has a tail, four legs, some fur, a muzzle, ears. It barks, has some teeth, has some paws. It can be a tiny little dog that could weigh a couple of pounds, or it could be a gigantic St. Bernard that could weigh over 100 pounds. Dogs come in all kinds of shapes, sizes, and forms. So as I was starting to reframe dog from a more personal point of view, starting to describe the variations of the dogs, the students started to lean in. I said, I'm curious, how many of you have ever actually owned a dog? They raised their hands. Most of them had. How many of you have a dog right now? Raise your hand. 75% of the students raised their hands. I said, okay, Susie, what is your dog like? Does your dog have a name? And Susie said, yeah, my dog's name is Montford. And I said, well, tell me more about Montford. Well, Montford is a very small dog. Montford barks when I come home. Montford sleeps with me. Montford and I go on long walks together. My father gave me Montford 3 years ago when it was my birthday, and I've had Montford ever since. I love my dog, Montford. Oh, so Montford has a lot going for him. Yeah, Montford is great. He has a great personality. She went on and on and on. I asked another student to do the same. And what's your dog's name? Well, my dog's name is Comet. Oh, so tell me about Comet. Oh, Comet is a German shepherd, and he lives outside. And Comet always barks when strangers come around. And I feel safe because Comet is always in the yard, and Comet takes care of me. I asked two or three others, and each student could name the dog. Each student had a very distinct experience with the dog in their lives. And then I said, how many of you have ever lost a dog? Here we come back to death. Some students raised their hands. I called on one. I said, what's your name? My name's Joy. So Joy, you lost your dog. Yeah, I lost my dog. You could see the sadness in Joy's face. I said, well, what was your dog's name? He said, well, my dog's name was Chumpy. And I said, Chumpy, what was Chumpy like? And as he described Chumpy, you could hear the longing in his voice, the grief, really, in his voice over the death of his dog, Chumpy. Chumpy had died, and he told me how Chumpy had died. Chumpy died of old age. We had Chumpy for years. Everybody loved Chumpy. And when Chumpy died, we buried him in the backyard. And then Joy described the memorial service they had for Chumpy. And he even said, you know, sometimes I still go out to where we buried Chumpy, and I think about how much fun I had when Chumpy was in my life. Two or three more children raised their hands and told similar stories about dogs in their lives. I figure I spent about 10 or 15 minutes having this conversation with all of these students. They leaned in more and more and more, and as we continued to talk, they became more and more animated about the dogs they'd lost, how their dogs died, how their dogs came into their lives, what their dogs had done. One ran away. 2 weeks later, it came back. And as you are listening to me tell this story, I'll bet you have more than one story about a dog in your life, and you may well have lost a dog. A lot of people who lose their pets grieve for quite a while. The pet industry is really dynamic. I've had friends spend $25,000 to extend their dog's life for a year and a half comfortably, and yet $25,000 is a lot to spend on a dog unless you're completely, utterly, totally committed. And my friend was. He could afford it, so that's what he did. And I suspect it was worth it because every time he tells the story about Thurston chasing the squirrel in the park not too far from his house, he lights up and says, you know, Thurston had a little bit more time and he got to chase a few more squirrels and it was worth it to me and I believe it was worth it to Thurston. So when my friend told his story about Thurston, he was as animated as those 6th, 7th, and 8th graders were telling the stories they had about their dogs. Thurston lasted a year and a half more, and then he died. Here we are again, back to death. Are we unlabeling the word death, or are we just using it as a character in our lives? Probably a little bit of both. Since this was a workshop for students to learn how to become more engaged writers, you've already guessed the next step. I said to these students, you've told me stories about your dogs. You now know there's more to a dog than four legs, tail that's wagging, some fur, a muzzle, some ears, eyes. Dogs are very, very personal to many of you. So what I would like for you to do now is to write your dog's name down on a blank sheet of paper. And now I would like for you to take 10 minutes, and I would like for you to enthusiastically describe your relationship with your dog. Include details. Include the emotions you feel. Let the atmosphere of your sensibilities emerge on the page. Tell us a story about your dog. By this point, the students were so engaged, and Tom, being the good teacher that he was, had prepared them to write, so they all had paper and pencils and whatnot. They were writing before I finished my brief. Off they go. 10 minutes later, they had all written. The room was quiet, generated some fantastic work. I said, please, some of you read the work out loud. Some volunteered, some didn't. I was running out of time, so I didn't have time to hear all of the students, but I did have time to hear 3 or 4, maybe 5 even. I don't remember now. And when they read, the work was lively. It was descriptive, full of tension, full of praise, sadness, grief, and all of the rest that you might expect. The students would never have been able to do this if I said, here's a prompt, a dog, write about a dog. Wouldn't have gotten any of this. But as they allowed their emotional sensibilities to become more and more engaged, more enlivened, by the time they wrote, they were really able to relabel the dog. So it was very clear they had a bit of transformation. They started to understand the power of connecting with something that was important to them. The power of labeling, unlabeling, relabeling, naming, paying attention. And when I left, they all thanked me. Later, Tom compiled all of the material and sent it to me. As you might imagine, very lively, fantastic stuff. Everybody had engaged quite a bit. Tom was pleased with the work. I was, and the students were most especially pleased. And I thanked Tom afterwards, telling him how much I appreciated his work with his students. Not every teacher spends that much time giving students room to dig into something like we dug into during that session. So I was grateful to that as well. On a personal dog note, I have to say, when I was growing up in Western North Carolina, we had dogs in our lives. I don't really remember them all that well. The dog I remember most was my dog Traveler. He was a little German Shepherd collie type dog. and I acquired Traveler from the dog pound, and Traveler and I took a trip. That's why I called him Traveler. I was going on a trip. I wanted to have Traveler come along with me to protect the car. I was traveling across America in the wintertime, going to California in the 1968 Plymouth station wagon. I was sleeping in the station wagon. The goal was to sell T-shirts to hiking stores up and down the coast of California. I figured if I was going to be in all kinds of different situations, it'd be good to have a dog in the car. I don't know if it worked out or not. Nobody robbed my car, so I suppose maybe Traveler did his job. I really connected with Traveler on that trip, and he and I stayed together for a long, long time, and I used to go whistle like that, and his little ears would perk up, and he would wag his tail. So I have my own story of Traveler, and yes, Traveler did die. He got older and older, as we tend to do. I left him with my mother and my sister. They took care of him when I was traveling, and one day Traveler just didn't show up. He was gone. Nobody knew where he went. I assume Traveler didn't make it. He had died that day. Well, about 6 months later, when summer faded, it was around October, maybe November, I was walking down the road beside my mother and sister's house, and I noticed Traveler's collar along the edge of the road. I looked at that collar, and I noticed there was not much left of Traveler. His teeth. One tooth was missing. That's how I knew it was Traveler. Of course, the collar was also distinctive. So what had happened? Traveler was old. He had been tottering around on the road, and somehow he'd gotten in the way of a car, and a car had hit him. And obviously, he died right there. So to this day, I can remember Traveler, the lively dog, traveling with me to California, and also remember seeing what was left of Traveler along the road. I didn't do anything with it. I left it right there, where I didn't bury Traveler. I didn't scrape the remains up and do some ritual. I thought this is the appropriate place for Traveler to rest. Did I weep? No. Did I feel sad? Yes. Do I feel a tug right now telling you this story about Traveler? Yeah, I sure do. I love my old dog Traveler, and I'm pretty sure he loved me back. So now, as we're relabeling, redefining, rethinking the power of words, I loved my old dog Traveler, and I'm pretty sure he loved me back. You know, it's almost impossible to talk or think about death and avoid talking and thinking about love. So here we loop back to poetry. Here's a very short poem by Langston Hughes, title, Poem. To F.S., I loved my friend. He went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends soft as it began. I loved my friend. I'll say it again just because it's short. I loved my friend. He went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends soft as it began. I loved my friend. In this poem, Langston Hughes never says his friend died. You actually don't know if his friend died. Maybe his friend moved away. Maybe his friend became no longer his friend. You know the friend is no longer there. The friend is gone. Friend went away from him. And that's important to know. You can speak of death without ever saying the word death. When you're writing, you can speak of almost anything without actually naming the thing that you're speaking about. This poem by Langston Hughes has a special significance for me because years ago, when I was using it as a teaching tool in classrooms, I would travel around the country, perform poetry on stage, and then go into the classrooms, discuss the meanings of the poems with the students. The idea was if you memorize a poem, if you perform it, you're going to know it better than if you just casually read it a couple of times and move on your merry way. So we were having a discussion about what this poem meant to the students, not what it means, but what it meant to each student. So I asked each student to just imagine a story around someone they had lost, someone had moved away, some absence, and think of a story that was significant for them. this wasn't so much a writing class. It was more of an imagining class, really. And I then said, well, does anybody have a comment? Anybody come up with anything that might be interesting, something you've lost? Hand went up, eighth grader. Let's call her Sarah. I said, Sarah, what do you have? She said, well, I have something that it's really interesting. I said, well, what is it? What is it? Who did you lose? She said, well, I imagined myself as a zookeeper. I said, okay. And my only job in the zoo was to take care of the last animal in a species. This was it. This was the last one. And after that, they're all gone. The species is extinct. There's nothing left. I loved my friend. He went away from me. And she said, that's a big, profound loss. This was back in the early 90s, before the environmental pressure that we know today existed. And yet it was there back then as well. It was clear Sarah understood that the death of the animal was the death and extinction of a species, which was a much, much greater, more impactful death, suggesting the death of our own species, which I don't think she was thinking of. And yet, upon reflection, as I've thought about this over the years, I do think about that. What if we, as humans, are not able to survive as a species? Death would then have a different meaning. The Earth might not mind. The Earth would be happy with it. But the humans would be gone. They might not mind either at that point. The poet Sarah Teasdale, who lived from 1884 to 1933, really sums up this notion in her poem, There Will Come Soft Rains. I'd like to tell it for you right now. Wartime. There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground and swallows circling in their shimmering sound and frogs in the pools singing at night and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire whistling their whims on the low fence wire. And not one will know of the war. Not one will care at last when it's done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone. Sarah Teasdale opens this poem with wartime in parentheses, and then she says there will come soft rains and the smell of the ground. The moment she introduces war, she's introduced death. She's also introduced survival, struggle, friendship, deep love, patriotism, conflict, hatred, evil, joy, desire, and every element of the human condition that you can possibly imagine. It all happens in wartime, and death is part of that happening. Reimagining, reframing, unlabeling, label off, label on, label off, label on, label off, label on. Our range is dramatic when we think about these things. So let's go back to E.E. Cummings for a minute. Mr. Death, what do you think of that?
Well, I will tell you. I've been Mr. Death since the beginning of death. I will tell you, yes, I know what the rivers look like. I know what the fire looks like. I know what it means to travel. I am Mr. Death, after all. I know what it means to visit the loved ones. I know what it means to watch the corn come up in the spring garden. I know what it means when someone weeps over a broken heart. I am, after all, Mr. Death. What does it mean to me? I can be anywhere, anytime. I am anybody, anywhere, anytime. I visit. I express myself. I come back again and again. I am Mr. Death. My friends are life, breath, dreams, visions, eternity, and all of the things in between. I have enough knowledge to show you how to walk on the stars as well as to walk on the ground.
I am, after all, Mr. Death. And that's what Mr. Death had to say about what Mr. Death does. Poetry does relabel things. The poetic sensibilities relabel things. Death also relabels things. Now let's talk about the death of the small things. The small, little deaths that happen. The death of a pint of ice cream after you've eaten the entire thing because you really didn't mean to, but you just had to do it because, I mean, who doesn't like chocolate? You might or might not like. I love chocolate. Some people don't like it, but I like it. It's a great rhetorical question. The little deaths, the death of a weekend. Would Mr. Death come to the weekend to watch the weekend die and everybody else goes away and heads back to work on Monday? Well, maybe so. Maybe Mr. Death might accept that invitation. Not do anything, but just relax. Take the weekend off. Imagine such a thing. The little deaths. A lot of people who do theater work will talk about the little death or sometimes the big death they feel when the show closes and the stage is empty and they walk out onto the street and they're just there passing the coffee shop, watching the taxi turn at the corner, maybe seeing a stranger crossing in another direction. Nobody sees them. Nobody recognizes them. The show's over. A profound sense of loss. A little death. The show is no more. So in a sense, every day is a day filled with little deaths, also beginnings. All of life is about beginning again. And it's also about leaving things behind. So as we relabel, rethink, unlabel, move things around, it's important to remember that all of this movement has a collective value. It works together to make your life. And at the end, sure, you're going to die. And as you move toward that inevitable moment, you are collecting all of these experiences. You are experiencing the little deaths, maybe the big deaths when you lose people, the little successes, the big successes, and all of the elements and variables that make up your life. So when I think about what I'm going to say for 6 minutes on the stage, I have a fairly good sense that one of the best ways to unlabel death is to spend a bit of time thinking about the multiple meanings death has for us and how valuable it is as a contrast for our life. Life, death, death, life, and on it goes. So to label death as something that is narrow comes, I think, from a bit of fear, perhaps. I don't know what's going to happen after I die. I am therefore afraid. I love my life now. I don't want to lose this life. This is the only life I have. Now, there is the fear, and I have this fear too, that at the end, there will be no more light. There will be nothing. It will be empty. Some people will tell you they believe they will go on to live an eternal life. I somewhat believe that in the sense that I believe life is eternal, no matter whether you're alive on earth or elsewhere. If eternity is infinity and infinity is everywhere, and eternity and infinity contain energy and life, how could this experience be anything other than eternal life? Now, it's not eternal life that I am thinking so much about here. What I would like to maintain is eternal awareness of where I am in whatever dimension I'm in. What I really would like to do is to go out into the dimension in my spirit form. It has to be a spirit. I'm certainly leaving my body behind, and take my full abilities to be aware, to enjoy what I enjoy, to experience what I experience. Take those abilities into the other dimensions. It's quite a leap for me to think about how that would happen, because once I leave my body, my soul, my spirit, which is the only ghost I have. It's in my body. My ghost is what is animating me now. Once it goes away, I have no idea where it will go. I have never been in places like that.
I only expect to do it once. That will be somewhere down the line. I am in my 70s now. Probably won't be too long until I have that experience. I can tell you right now, in this moment, recording this show in Manila on Chinese New Year in the middle of the day, February the 17th, I'm not really afraid of death. If I have a fear, it's a fear of not being able to make another podcast. It's a fear of not being able to write another poem. It's a fear of not being able to have another conversation with a friend. It's a fear of not being in the arms of someone I love. I have those fears. I don't know if that's on the other side or not. I have to trust it's somehow going to sort itself out. Let's go back for a moment to some poetry. Talk about unlabeling and labeling concepts of death and love. Elizabeth Barrett Browning does a great job in her sonnet from the Portuguese number 43, How Do I Love Thee? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. When feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace, I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, How Do I Love Thee? She brings death up, and yet she frames it in a very, very beautiful, loving way. It's aspirational. So here we are, unlabeling death, lightening up the load around death. For Elizabeth Barrett Browning, it's a way of speaking how much she cares about her husband, Robert Browning. Now, Robert Browning wrote a poem titled My Last Duchess, which is also about death, but it's not a very loving poem. If you want to find out what happens in that monologue poem, My Last Duchess by Robert Browning, Elizabeth Barrett Browning obviously loved her husband and did want to love him for eternity. So could we unlabel death and give it the name eternity? Could we unlabel death, rename death, and give it the label of love? Could we lowercase death, something casual? Does death fit into breath? Breath and death rhyme. Do they do more than rhyme? My last breath, and then there was death. Of course, unlabeling death, moving yourself away from the attachments you have around death, how you believe about death, what it means to you, it's a lot easier said than done. Death carries with us its own characteristics. Mr. Death is there, talking to us throughout our entire life. So to casually say, oh, you should relabel death. I am not that naive. I am not foolish here. I understand this is something that takes a long time to think about. And I think that's what Aditi is addressing here. How can we commit to expanding our thinking around the concept of death, which many of us have labeled difficult, challenging, frightful, scary, interesting, intriguing, worth a conversation, and multiple other labels that we put on and put off. This concept of death, Mr. Death, we live with, and yet we still constantly try to understand all the way up to the last living moment. So now as we move toward the last part of our time together, I'd like to give you a story about a little death. About a fellow named Jack who leaves town, moves away, goes somewhere else, leaves the people behind to
to do whatever they do on their own. This story is titled Tulsa Pool Player. So listen to this tale, and as you listen, can you identify any small little deaths? What happens? He played pool, that boy from Tulsa. His name was Jack, and he could scatter those pool balls like rainbows across a green sky. He was dusty. His hands were quick, and his deep eyes won hearts. Never more than one light bulb above my table, Jack would say. I hate to squint while I win. $50 and enough stamina to play all night would get you into one of Jack's games. All the boys down at the pool hall smoked and leaned forward as they watched Jack's pool balls orbit straight into the hungry corners. Jack's mouth was always open, just a little bit. And when he laughed, you could hear the money rustling in his pockets. Even the rack boys stood still on the afternoon. Jack's cue ball nicked a yellow 9 and spun the last black 8 into the corner. When the ball dropped and Jack lost the game, he stood quiet for a second, then shook his head and said, "Boys, rounds are on me." The day after Jack left town, the boys started swearing their cue balls were running just a little bit straighter, and they said everybody's luck had improved. On Christmas Eve, word came back that a brown-haired West Texas girl from the Apache Mountains had spun past Jack on the break and left him $1,000 down by dawn. They said it didn't bother Jack one bit. He just leaned his cue stick against the counter, kicked his boots back, bought her a cup of coffee. When this story bounced around the pool room, those boys all tipped their glasses back. They laughed out loud, and they left every single cue stick in the house standing straight up at attention. He played pool, that boy from Tulsa. His name was Jack, and he could scatter those pool balls like rainbows across a green sky. And that's a little story about Jack, the Tulsa pool player. Of course, the little death in this story about Jack was when he left the pool room. All the boys relied on Jack. He was the one who set the standard. He was the one who raised the stakes. He was the one who gave them a sense that they could go beyond where they were. And yet they stayed on. They continued to play. Another Jack probably showed up. And when the story about Jack comes back, these boys honor somebody that's no longer there, the little death. Jack is no longer there. He's gone. But his spirit lives on. And I think that is what is important. And keeping on the subject of death and the finality of it and the big and the little death part, we've all had a Jack in our lives. Somebody comes along and just says one thing to you, changes the whole way you move through life. And I've always had one poem in my life that meant a great deal to me. It's Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. And it is definitely about the big death, because in the poem Ulysses, which I've recited more than once here on this show, in that poem, Ulysses has returned from his great journeys. He's now living in his kingdom, the king. He's back. He's sitting on the throne. The whole thing is his. He knows his life is coming to a close. He can see his death encroaching. And yet, what is a Ulysses doing? The guy is sitting on a rock, looking out over the harbor, thinking about what he's going to do next, fully aware that his death is right there on his shoulder. Talk about Mr. Death. Mr. Death's probably the captain of the ship. Ulysses retired. Mr. Death took over the ship. And Ulysses is thinking, what am I going to do next? I don't want to rule the kingdom anymore. I'll leave that to my son. My wife is here with all that she's done. All the people around me, my subjects, they're doing fine. And he's looking at that ocean, that dark ocean, and thinking, my death is out there, my life is out there, and everything I know about who I am is out there in that roaring sea. And he says this. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off. And sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we'll touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. And that's the last part of Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Ulysses is speaking. And the line that Ulysses says that reframes, unframes, expands the notion of death, and has been a guiding star for me for years is the line, "For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die." I love that line because he's acknowledging that he is going to die, and yet he's also acknowledging that he will continue beyond the baths of all the western stars. And when he says, until I die, he's acknowledging it's eternal. He knows his body will die. He also knows that his spirit will keep on going forever and forever, or at least he has the faith that it will. He can't know it for sure, but does that matter? No, it's the reframing. He has a sense that all that he has lived, all the momentum he has, will go on forever and forever. I'd like to think it will for all of us. So there you go, my friends. That's really all I have right now on relabeling death. I hope you've gotten some insights from my thinking and the poetry that I've offered you. Here's to all of the poets in the world who are thinking about that. And if you're one of them, hats off to you. Well done. I appreciate it so much. And so I will take this opportunity to just say thank you very much. And I'll sign off a little early. I have to take this around to the top of the hour. I have 57 minutes because it is a radio show as well as a podcast. So I'll say goodbye now. And afterwards, I'll play a few tunes just to take you up to the top of the hour. On that note, you've been listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. This show airs every weekend on WPVM-FM and KCEI, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. Devine Dial, thank you ever so much for managing WPVM-FM. And Mike Tilley, Robin Collier, thank you for doing the same. KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. I really do appreciate it. Walter Parks, thank you so much for the theme song. WalterParks.com for more on Walter's music. You can always reach me, Nave@JamesNave.com. Would love to hear from you. What's your story? Where are you in the world? What's it all about? How does it play? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're free on any Saturday between 12 and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, JamesNave.com will take you to a free Imaginative Storm writing gathering. It's a community gathering. The door is always open. We have a great writing group, and if you ever want to be part of it, you can go to JamesNave.com, and there you'll find the information for it. Like I said, it's free. We'd love to have you be part of our community. And so on that note, again, thanks ever so much for spending a little time with me, and I do hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line. Now here are a few tunes to take you home.
I was a stranger in the city. Out of town were the people I knew. I had that feeling of self-pity. What to do, what to do, what to do? The outlook was decidedly blue. But as I walked through the foggy streets alone, it turned out to be the luckiest day I've known. A foggy day in London town had me low, it had me down. I viewed the morning with alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wondered, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. For suddenly I saw you there, and through foggy London town the sun was shining everywhere. Had me down. I viewed that morning with such alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wonder, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. For suddenly I saw.
I'll be yours. wanders through all the years till the end of time. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfilled. For my darling, I love you, and I always will. For my darling, I love you, and I always
Santana.
It sounds like you've always felt that music is a healing force, and you've become more and more out about that to the general public.
I want to grab that part that you just said from the OJs. Music is the healing force of the world. You know, I love music, you know. But there's a part in there which says music is the healing force of the world. See, that's what we need to constantly broadcast in radio. You know, how music, mystical medicine music, heals a twisted, crooked world.
Oh, man.
There it is.
We need the medicine now more than ever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's there. And all we have to do is just turn it up.
It's all work and no play. It's just another day.